Tom, you've identified some serious traps here waiting for pilots that can misinterpret radar data. What is the message we're sending to our listeners here?
Well, I think that what we really need to think about is that the aerodynamics of light airplanes have not changed. For decades, the advice has always been to stay 20 miles away from thunderstorm activity. And in the context of this scenario, the potential for convective activity or at least turbulent activity, the combination of the heavy rain showers in the hilly mountainous terrain there. The advent of cockpit weather displays can be viewed in one of two different ways. Can I use this information to try to get closer to the weather? Or can I use it as a means to more accurately stay away from the weather? And that's, I think, where we need to aim pilot education. Use these devices to make it even easier to stay 20 miles away from the hazardous weather.
You know, that gets back to the understanding of just what a serious hazard to aviation thunderstorms are. And it really is easy. You know, tools can be used to help us. They can be used to hurt us. And this is a tool that inappropriately used will hurt us rather than help us.
I agree, but I'm not seeing this as a thunderstorm situation. And, you know, looking at the options here, I actually like option two. I like diverting somewhat to the south, to the lighter areas. I'm in light precipitation, probably not even moderate. I have two sources of onboard data link weather to watch things progress. I have me in the cockpit and what I'm experiencing in terms of turbulence. And we can get at least to the point closer to the coast where we can let the worst of it pass by and then make a scoot up the coast. If we stay, we're stuck for quite some time if this turns into embedded thunderstorms, which I definitely don't want to go through.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've actually done several similar things myself many times where I have made a choice like going to San Diego, and I thought about that very hard in this scenario as well. The reason that I chose not to is because we have some pretty intensive rain showers, and I don't know the Southern California area well myself, but I have been out there a few times, and when it rains hard, it's usually pretty towering cumulus sort of cloud development bumping up against the mountains. And so as someone maybe who is not as familiar with that particular geography, as someone who in this scenario was flying back and forth all the time, I'd be less likely to want to try to fly through it.
Well, I'm always a little bit leery of XM or ADS-B weather information because of the delay inherent in it. As one who got used to real-time radar, I've seen some big differences in the appearance of the precipitation on real time versus the XM, for instance. But what element I would bring into play here is Mach 2 eyeballs. Do you see cumulus out there? If you see cumulus, I wouldn't get anywhere near it in this situation. Regardless of what the convective outlook was, I'm more inclined to go the route that Jeff just defined. Head down towards San Diego. If it takes longer, it takes longer. Stay away from anything that could conceivably develop into convective activity, particularly if I see cumulus. I'm out of there. I'm going nowhere near it.
And your IMC, just to make it clear as we're talking here, per the scenario, you're in the clouds when you're making this decision.
Well, that assumes no brakes at all, that you don't get to see anything out the window. You know, that would be unlikely that you didn't take a gander at what was out there.
I have to tell you, gentlemen, that I was for option two until I heard Tom's explanation of how these gadgets work, and I learned some things from there. I think if you choose option two, going to San Diego, it certainly is a viable option, but he points out some pretty good hazards. There's a significant dark green down that way, as I recall, or some dark green, which I've now learned, if I'm looking at my iPad, is actually the same decibel level as yellow. And I'm not inclined to want to fly through any yellow stuff because the next thing comes is red, and we know that stuff is all delayed. So I've changed my mind, and I'm back with Tom going to go back to Las Vegas.
Well, and I have to say, too, that, you know, you're just started on this flight, and do you really want to be making it up as you go along, or do you want to be back on the ground in 10 minutes where you're in a much better position to evaluate and get the data you really want to make a decision, as opposed to, we've talked many times about the difference between making a decision on the ground versus in the air, and the more capability you have and the more resources that you have and the better data you have. So I think that would incline me towards option one rather than option two.
Well, I don't know. I'm going to be the challenger here again. What more data would you have on the ground?
Real time?
Well, what you see on ADS.
You're in the weather. Oh, so well, I thought you're saying you were talking about looking out the window.
If you sit down at the computer and pull up the weather, you're not going to see anything much different, maybe a little bit different than what you see in the cockpit.
I would accept that if I turned around and landed at Las Vegas, I pretty much know I'm going to be there for a while. Reevaluating on the ground really means wait until the system passes through in this scenario, the way
that's,
I see
that's
that.
About the size of it. I agree
yeah, that's
with you
about
there.
It.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, back to Bob's point, I haven't flown in the scenario part of the country much. I fly a lot in the Midwest and in the Southeast United States. And over the years, I've learned that if I'm dealing with any sort of heavy precipitation, I want to be able to see it. And if I'm not able to maneuver and deviate around most of the cloud activity, that's right there going to put me on the ground. I decide at that point. So if I'm in an embedded solid IMC situation like this, and I'm seeing some indications of what may be turbulence ahead, I have no other way to determine whether or not it's hazardous until I actually get into it. Personally, I'm going to turn around and land.
I think we need to really reaffirm what we had talked about briefly about understanding the differences between these various weather sources. And that's really what they are, is weather sources. And they're all varying depictions of some type of information that's coming to us. So understanding the source and ADS-B may be a different source than XM, which may be a different source than internet-based. You don't really know where this stuff's coming from. Somehow it's coming through this pipe and you know, it's being displayed to you in a manner that the designer, the developer of the software or whatever has decided to display it. So you have to understand that. But given that, I think also that we tend to can lead ourselves down a path by labeling it as radar. And it's not really radar. You know, you think back to like, remember when airplanes used to have like radar equipped over the door as you were entering from the jetway? You know, radar equipped, we can fly through anything. Well, this isn't really radar. This is it's information, and you have to use that information to base your decision on, and you can't do it in a tactical manner. It's a strategic planning tool, and you really have to understand that even that 20 miles from the edges of the returns may not be sufficient. And then in other cases, we get kind of led down a path where there's been many times where I've seen green or even dark green, and it's precipitation that's up at 20,000 feet. You fly under it and you don't even get wet. So you really got to understand what all this information is telling you and use that to make the decision too.
But getting back to the choices we have here, although I tended to go with choice number two, head down to San Diego, certainly Tom's choice number one, the least comfortable pilot wins, I think really does prevail here. Now, I might think it's more reasonable to do number two, but if the other pilot isn't comfortable with that, then that counts. That counts.
And have you really, you know, validated that southern route? I mean, that's an alternate route. I mean, have you really done enough preparation to know that you're, you know, not heading into something that's equally challenging just because it was not your planned flight? You're kind of making it up as you go along. And I always say once you start doing that, you know, you're kind of behind the airplane as opposed to in front of the airplane. And that's why I tend to favor the more conservative approach. And once again, do we want to avoid or do we want to use the tools to skirt?
Yeah, that's fair enough. But I mean, I would think that there's a certain level to which you need to have the ability to make it up as you go along. Situations change. You do have an objective. You're trying to get home. And if it's within the capability of the plane and the people and within a reasonable margin of safety, then experimenting and making it up as you go along as you're keeping your outs available, makes a lot of sense. You've got two pilots in this cockpit too. You've got passengers in the back who we've said they're okay with rain and some turbulence. You know, they're not going to panic if it bounces a little bit. So we have some latitude to work with here. I think part of the issue, or I really should say, what needs to happen is there need to be some parameters, right? Okay, we can press on within this. If either of us get physically uncomfortable, we're out of here. If the radar returns, you know, we're talking about colors, but the real key is DBZ level. And one way to look at it is to say that, you know, 30 or lower, I'm comfortable intentionally flying into that, right? As long as I'm not seeing convective activity, the scalloping, if you will, or the, you know, the contour line, some people call it, how quickly you go from green to yellow to something else, say, are really far apart. You know, it's very wide and shallow. All right, that gives me some confidence. I'm not seeing lightning strikes. That gives me some confidence. I'm willing to intentionally fly into 30. I'm willing to continue on through below 40. I'm not going to try and go into it maybe, but I'm going to go out of it without having to declare an emergency or immediately land if I'm not seeing other indications of convection. Anything above that, I'm out of here. I don't even care if it's still smooth. This is too much just energy in the air. It's almost certainly going to be turbulent somewhere nearby that I want. And putting some kind of objective numbers helps get a parameters, if you will, boundary conditions on how I'm willing to make things up as I go along in the air and come up with a way to hopefully get home.
One of the factors for me in evaluating that, you know, do I fly through green or not? Well, first off, Dr. Strawley's view that if there's any yellow or red in there anywhere, you need to avoid all of it because it's all part of the same system that's creating this turbulence. The other is the interaction between the dark green returns and the mountainous terrain beneath it, because each one of those on its own could potentially create turbulent activity. So being unfamiliar with that particular area, the two of those combined would give me pause. I really wouldn't want to go there.
Do we as a group think that the two pilots in the cockpit have the information they need to make a good decision?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think they have a reasonable amount of information to proceed, to work with. I don't think they can get more, right, other than some ride reports maybe.
But I'm certainly feeling a comfort level issue on the part of the pilot in command.
Well, we haven't talked about the fact that they may or may not have researched pilot reports, although that's old data. They have air traffic control to ask about ride data as well. So there is a few more pieces of information they might get that could influence them one way or another.
But landing, going back to Vegas and landing, although that's to me that's still a viable option, is not really going to provide them any more information than you can get off an iPad or with ADS-B
in
the cockpit.
Right on the ground. They're not going to find that.
No, you're not going to find that anymore.
No, it's an escape, not a way to get more information.
Right, and a lot of times we've traditionally said we'll land and get a briefing or something. You know, that's ancient history now. So we've got pretty much everything that we need to do, but that doesn't mean that you couldn't try and negotiate some other, you know, variation on an escape route or alternate route. But I don't think I would be happy with going straight ahead. That's for sure.
No. What would you select?
Maybe make a 180, go back to the valley, you know, head down towards Palm Springs, something like that. That might buy you some time, but you're flying away from home, so you're not really gaining anything. You're just burning gas going in the wrong direction
to the direct route.
Yeah, so yeah. I kind of agree with you. There's really not a lot to be gained by that. And you know, what's the worst if you went back to Vegas, you rent a car, a couple hours, you're home, you got to go back and get the plane next week or something. Going back that way has almost no downside. You're only 30, 40 miles back to Vegas.
Well, except listening to your plane partner just, you know, chewing you out the whole way home, right?
That's a good transition here because yeah. You mentioned, Jeff, you know, you got two pilots. And generally that's a plus. But in this situation, is it a plus? Because we have a little divergence here. And the pilot in command isn't necessarily the most experienced, but they're the pilot in command. And the other pilot may be leading you in a direction you don't want to go. Wally, you've flown with a lot of different pilots, and you've seen this interaction. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a very good possibility that the experienced pilot can talk the inexperienced pilot into doing something that's probably not too smart. And as the inexperienced pilot, you're going to tend to take experience from this other person who has allegedly been in this kind of weather. And as you point out in the scenario, it's a learning experience. But it may – that pilot may learn something they didn't want to learn.
Yeah. OJT is just that. It's OJT. And there's a upside and a downside to that way of learning.
Well, I'd be afraid that the regional pilot might be thinking of the flying through yellow returns in terms of what effect it has on a regional airliner as opposed to flying a Lion in a Columbia 400.
And being equipped with real-time radar.
Yeah, she probably didn't have NEXRAD.
Probably not.
There's probably two different kinds of yellow that are being talked about there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
One's
very
probably
much.
Forward-looking yellow and one's – you know, 40
and you're right.
Plus
you're,
DBZ.
And it's real-time information as opposed to information with some delay. Yes.
But that gets back to how do you resolve a conflict in the cockpit while we're in the air? And, you know, the roles have to be established in the airlines and military and stuff. There's established protocol. There's, you know, the airlines have spent millions of dollars doing all the CRM training and how to resolve these conflicts. But now you have one person who's been trained in that and one who hasn't. And how do you resolve that headbutting?
It brings us full circle back to least comfortable pilot wins.
And not only are they sort of partners in the airplane, they're partners in business. So this this puts a different strain on the relationship.
Yeah, different spin.
And you know, you talked, you know, as an option, a conscious decision, okay, you're the pilot in command now, which is, you know, kind of a little bit silly, but there can be a change of command that is done more subtly than that, that is even more dangerous because there is a below-the-level change of command, and then you really have nobody flying the airplane, nobody in charge, and this vehicle is progressing along, you know, rudderless, and that is a very dangerous situation.
So, as John said, you need to establish the roles before you take off. And as pilot in command, I will be acting as pilot in command of this flight. I would like you to help me with this, 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 and this, and this. I appreciate whatever input you have here, but ultimately, I'm the pilot in command. And you could use now. We talk about this being an educational experience. Is that, you know, are we now almost talking about this as being a dual instructional situation? Are you now acting in the capacity of an instructor teaching me how to do this? I think that it would be very valid to have an experienced pilot on board of the airplane to be able to help you better evaluate the situation ahead, but not necessarily to talk you into going into a hazardous situation just to see – that, yeah, you can do this if you really think about it. And I am concerned. We do see – I do see evidence of this a lot in the general aviation community where there is a progressive or rolling assumption of risk, the normalization of risk. We talk about that. That, you know, if – I mentioned it in the outbrief there. If they do go through the yellow and they do land at Santa Barbara, what does that teach – the lesser experienced pilot. Okay, things that I thought were rules that I should not violate are now okay to give it a shot and see how it works. Pretty soon you'll be flying into, well, let's see if we can go through a little bit of this pink and red on the side if you're not careful.
So I think we've identified some traps that exist with radar and interpretation of radar and recognizing that we're not looking at a radar display. There are lags in the information. And all of these things can contribute to us making very poor decisions. Along with that, we have to recognize that anytime we're in a cockpit with another pilot, there needs to be a clear delineation of who's the pilot in command and the roles and responsibilities that both of them have.